Tom, good morning to you.
May it please the court. My name is John Honig. I represent the appellant on this matter. Essentially, Your Honor, we have filed this appeal basically setting forth that the District Court of Polk County erred in granting a summary judgment to Heritage Bank on the lease forcible retainer action. We believe the court erred in many respects in that there was a number of factual issues which could be raised and or discussed and determined by a jury. Essentially, Your Honor, there are several disputed facts. One, and raised by the pleadings of the validity, or is Heritage Bank the trustee, the proper party to bring this action in the District Court of Polk County? Number two, the issues of fact on the terms of the written lease itself. Number three, the facts of dealings of the parties during the time in which the lease was in existence enforceable. There's an issue of fact as to dealings of the parties. There is a corresponding relationship between Mr. Charles Gable and Mr. James Gable, who had farmed for 40 years and were working under that same lease. And
are those material facts?
Well, I think they are, Your Honor, because if you really look at closely at the lease itself, there is the provision that provides for what I'm going to call a cure, save off reasonable time period. That was what those past transactions really were indicative of what that lease was. And that's what a jury, I believe, would be able to decipher as to whether or not the specific March 1st date was really a hard, fast date because of the language of the lease.
That would be the dispute that would preclude summary judgment, in your view?
I do, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Was the lease ambiguous?
The lease was not ambiguous, Your Honor, in the sense of not knowing what it was saying, but it is so broad. It's a broad lease. It says that...
Why would we look outside the lease itself?
Well, because the lease talks about notice and then giving the tenant a right to cure within a reasonable period of time. Historically, reasonable period of time would have said that those crops or the proceeds from those crops could be delivered in the fall as opposed to the spring. So it's not ambiguous, but it gives transactional parties past history relevance to what the bank is saying was a breach.
So the reasonableness of the cure.
Correct. Reasonable period of time to cure.
That creates somewhat of an ambiguous or open-ended issue.
Correct.
To look outside the lease to determine the practice of the parties.
Exactly. And I believe, Your Honor, that Judge Doherty simply ignored that paragraph. She referred to it. She just simply let it go on. Didn't address that factual pattern of what was happening in the past.
Counsel?
Yes.
There was two actions filed in Cass County, one for conservatorship and a separate action initiated by your client for trust administration. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And the trust administration, your client stipulated that Heritage Bank could become the trustee, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And we have the letters of trustee in the record, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Even if the conservatorship went away upon the death of Charles, how does that affect the separate legal proceeding of trust administration?
Well, I think, Your Honor, on the date of death, Charles Gable, subsequent to that death, was a petition for termination validity of that trust, and or the trust was executed by him in 15. So, I believe that the date of death effectively created a vacancy because we had competing trust
Okay. The date of death may affect a conservatorship, but again, how does it affect a separate legal proceeding on trust? The trust didn't go away immediately upon death. It just became irrevocable, and then you would distribute, you'd follow the terms of the trust at that point. But the trust administration had been filed before date of death. Heritage Bank had been appointed trustee in that action by stipulation of your client before date of death. So I guess I'm having a hard time understanding how the death, although it may affect the conservatorship, how did it affect the trust administration?
Well, the date of death affected trust administration, Mr. Galen's proceeding, because there was a second trust which effectively revoked trust that Mr. Galen was operating.
But you're contending that's not a valid trust.
That is correct.
You really can't argue it both ways, can you? I mean, if it's not a valid trust, then we go back to the trust you think is valid. That is involved in a pending trust administration that didn't terminate without court order, did it?
I believe we can, because if the trust, which was executed at the time where, after our trust, if that was the valid trust, then that effectively revoked our trust. So when Mr. Gable died, either Trust 1 or Trust 2 became the effective irrevocable trust. So, in essence, what I'm saying, Your Honor, if that second trust is valid, then there is no appointment under the first trust.
Okay,
because Heritage Bank was appointed the trustee under the second trust.
Until a court of law determines that the second trust is valid, back to my question, there is no order affecting naming your client, or not your client, but Heritage Bank as trustee within the trust administration. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay.
Not a matter of record, the petition to determine the will, the second will, has been determined to be basically valid influence, but it's not a part of the record, which is now being appealed also. Second will signed by Gable. I just would point that out to the court, but again, it's not a part of the record.
To return to this, this was a forcible entry and detainer action.
Yes, sir.
That we have.
Yes.
Did anyone demand a jury?
I did.
You did.
The other aspect, which I believe raised a clear question of fact, was the disposition or disparity of what did occur, what did not occur between Mr. Moyer, the president of the bank, and Mr. Reisinger, Mr. Gable's attorney, with regard to various checks for the rents, about when was to be delivered, how was to be delivered. And to me, Your Honors, the issue, again, goes to the construction, or not the construction, but what a jury would determine. Was there a breach or was there not a breach because of the interrelationships happening between Heritage Bank, Mr. Gable, Mr. Gable's attorney, Heritage's attorney, and so forth. So again, I believe those are in fact also questions to be determined by the jury.
Counsel, the court in its order said that it had ordered the proceeds to be paid into the court and your client failed to do it, I think within 30 days or something like that's in the order. My question is this though, does the court become part of the process for the cure, or is that, should that have all been established before the court proceeded?
I think the somewhat complicated, because the crops were sold, the proceeds were available prior to March 8th. Then as the proceeding occurred, because I raised the issue as to who the real party is at the very, very start. And because of that, Judge Doherty, I believe, became involved in trying to get somehow rents to Heritage Bank. That process took some time, but after that order came out, there was no specific time. It just simply says deliver the proceeds to the clerk of the district court. And that's exactly what Mr. James Gable did. Granted, it was 45 days, but to me, that's not an unreasonable considering that it was contemplated that there would be some time for him to get the checks back from Mr. Reisinger, then get it deposited to the court, because he then had to also get the signature of Cornerstone Bank on those checks because they were a secured lender. So I don't believe that was unreasonable, but I guess to answer your question directly, yes, I believe it probably should have been determined prior to the loan situation.
Okay, thank you.
Time, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Rowett, good morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning, sir. May it please the court, my name is Kent Rowett. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Heritage Bank, who is, we believe, to be the trustee of the Charles Gable Trust. Of course, obviously familiar with the circumstances in this particular matter, and it's our belief that there was no genuine issue of material fact, and that the district court order granting summary judgment in this matter in favor of the trust was appropriate.
Counsel, the judge's order at the end simply reads, the motion for summary judgment is sustained, period. It is so ordered. What is the judge ordered there?
Well, I wish that would have been a little bit more clear. What we were seeking, obviously, was a summary judgment on our forcible entry and detainer cause of action. So what I took that language to include the termination of the existing lease agreement and allowing us through the forcible entry and detainer statutes to seek the assistance of the court and the sheriff's department in removing Mr. Gable.
And I know you're not a sheriff, but if this order, someone puts this order on your desk, along with some type of writ of execution, how do you know what to do? I mean, don't the orders have to be such that they can be executed upon?
I agree with you as a general proposition. I think that this order is specific enough when you take into context the particular cause of action. I don't want to say a simple cause of action, but again, that focused on one particular remedy, which is removing an individual from the property.
Within the four corners of the document, is it sufficient to be executed upon?
I think so.
Sounded to me like you were referring to pleadings or some other extraneous document.
Well, and I'd have to go back and look through it, but I think that Judge Doherty makes reference to the fact that it's on this particular cause of action is the forcible entry. I haven't gone, admittedly, to look at that particular issue, but I
suppose
think
it doesn't say all that.
Well, then you would have to go back and look at the amended complaint.
And if we cannot, if it's not proper to look to the amended complaint, isn't that plain error?
Well, I guess assuming that your assumption is correct that you can't, and I don't think that that's the case, but
How is a court clerk supposed to know to issue a writ of execution when the purported judgment doesn't specify the relief to be granted?
Well, I understand the problem. Again, I would come back to assuming that there's no mention that this is an FEB action as part of the order, which I'd have to look. I assume that it does. If it doesn't speak to that, again, I think it still has got the ability to go back and take a look.
So we let clerks interpret pleadings to determine whether or not writs of execution should be issued? And how is that consistent with the statute that requires a judgment to be rendered by a judge and to set forth the relief that's granted?
I understand what you're saying, Judge, and I obviously didn't draft this order.
It was the order
I was given, so I was happy because it sustained my position, but I also similarly realize the limitations that you're pointing out with.
All right. Thank you.
Counsel, I'm going to shift gears on you. In your brief, or in the lease, it says that the lessor is to notify the tenant where to deliver the crops, and that shall be within, I believe, what was it, 15 miles of the farm?
Correct.
Okay. In your brief, you reference Exhibit 13 as complying with that requirement of demanding delivery. But I couldn't find anywhere in Exhibit 13 that you reference a site within 15 miles of the farm. Is there some other part of the record that I should be looking at that would support your position in your brief?
Well, and I apologize because I don't remember exactly what Exhibit 13 is.
It's an affidavit of Heritage Bank president.
It may have been a supplemental affidavit. I think that it's undisputed between the parties, Judge, that there was an email transaction that took place between Sam Lawyer, who was the president of Heritage Bank, and Mr. Davis' counsel, Mr. Hahn.
Is that email part of our record? Because they dispute that you gave them proper notice.
Well, I understand they dispute that, but if you take a look at their brief, they admit that they received that email correspondence.
But what we don't know what that email correspondence is, do
well,
we?
Well, I understand that, but like I said, there's a portion of their brief where they admit that there was an email correspondence from the bank to Mr. Hahn indicating that the corn was to be delivered to Polk. I know there's some dispute as to whether Polk is within 15 miles of farms. As the crow flies, and Google Earth tells me, Polk is within 15 miles of the farms. I would point out that Mr. Gable makes reference in his brief that it would have been simpler to deliver the crops to Osceola, which is a mile away. That's true. Mr. Gable ultimately delivered those crops to Lincoln, which is 70 miles.
And how do we know that Polk is 15 miles from the farm from the record?
We wrestled with that issue, and there is nothing in the record that indicates that it's within 15 miles. There's nothing in the record that indicates that it's not.
Well, isn't the, at a summary judgment, wouldn't the burden be on you to show that?
I understand, Judge, but the corn wasn't delivered there. It wasn't delivered to Polk, it wasn't delivered to Osceola, it was delivered 70 miles away.
Isn't that a condition precedent that has to be satisfied in the lease?
Well, I think, I could be wrong, but I would think that the court would have the ability to take a look at that issue and determine the distance from one point to another.
Also, I want to ask you about, again, back to the order of the court. The court references that it ordered the tenant to pay the proceeds of the crop into the court and didn't do so within 30 days, so therefore the tenant had a chance to cure. Is that the court's function, to be involved in the curing of a lease, or should that all have occurred? Either the breach occurred or didn't occur, and the notice of default, wouldn't all that have occurred before the court action?
I don't know how the court would have aided in that process before the court action. I guess I'm not maybe...
Well, should the court have aided in it?
Well, we appreciated it at the time because the trust needed some money to be able to pay some of its outstanding bills, so we appreciated it at the time. Whether or not that's an appropriate role for a court, I don't know that it necessarily is in a regular forcible and detention.
I'm not trying to comment whether it was appropriate or inappropriate. My point is, wouldn't the breach and the notice of default, that would all have occurred before you got to court, wouldn't it?
Right.
Because even, let's go to a mortgage proceeding. Let's say that somebody's in default in their mortgage and they show up at court and say, well, we now have the money and we want to pay it everything. Can't the lender still proceed on foreclosure, even if they're willing to pay that at court, because the breach occurred before the court proceeding?
Right.
Isn't that the same principle true here, that you didn't, even if that money had been paid within 30 days, you still could have proceeded on the breach of the lease, couldn't you?
I agree with you, it was still a breach, and one thing that seems like it gets lost in this process a lot I guess I wanted to bring up this point, is this was a crop share lease. Okay? The responsibility of the tenant under this lease was to deliver us a crop, not deliver us a check or checks. And I know from working with the trustees, from working with farmers, there's a big distinction between those two. Individuals who have crop share leases like to have the ability to market their own crop. And we were deprived, trust was deprived of that opportunity to be able to market its own crop because Mr. Gable sold that crop, some of it in December of 2015, some of it in May of 2016, sold at two different times, and that deprived the trust of the ability to market. So I've taken the position to this that it doesn't matter that the checks were delivered, that he still breached the lease agreement because checks don't satisfy the lease agreement. Bushels of corn or soybeans delivered to an elevator is a waste of land. So that's been a position that I've taken through.
Thank you.
I have just a little bit of time left. I guess I wanted to mention one issue. We did file a motion with the Court of Appeals requesting that the complaint in this matter be amended. Part of that was, as it relates to Judge Cass's comments about the order not being very specific. In drafting the complaint, there was a piece of property that was not included as part of the trust. Now, that trust land was described in the lease agreement, and it was our feeling that Judge Doherty's order, the way it was drafted, terminated that lease agreement so that would apply to all of the trust land. If there's no further questions,
15 miles as the crow flies, do crows deliver corn? And I'm not being flippant about that, but don't you have to measure the mileage based on how the crop would actually be delivered?
Well, I understand exactly what you're saying. The lease was written, and I didn't draft the lease. None of you drafted the lease. Mr. Hahn didn't draft the lease. It says 15 miles. So crows do move corn around, as you're familiar, but they usually don't move around that quantity of corn. Usually you have to take a road to get there.
And one can envision circumstances where there's a natural boundary that you can't get there. The 15 miles, even though would as a line of sight may be within 15 miles, but the nearest bridge over the Platte River is 20 miles down the river.
I have driven from Osceola to Polk many times, and on the road that I have to take to get there, it takes longer than 15 miles.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. The next case.